Good morning. On today's programme, the humble beginnings of Australia's new Prime Minister and the Portuguese dam that has transformed the EU's poorest region. But first to Ukraine and the city of Kharkiv in the northeast of the country, which is just half an hour by car from the Russian border. The city came under heavy attack early in Russia's war on Ukraine. But in recent days, life has started to return to normal as attacks eased and citizens who fled the city returned, with bars, restaurants and public transport reopening. But as Jen Stout reports now from Kharkiv, the return to normality is fragile and the future uncertain.
In early May, I took a night train from Odessa on the Black Sea coast, diagonally across the vast territory of Ukraine, up to Kharkiv, near the Russian border. We boarded in darkness, a blackout in force at the station, people flashing phone torches to find the right carriage. "Is this a Kharkiv train?" I asked a lady with a gigantic dog. She stared at me, horrified. "No. Why on earth are you going to Kharkiv?" And indeed, our carriage was empty. Just my colleague and I, and the conductor, Artyom. The windows were taped up to stop shelling shattering the glass, and I peered out at the smudged view of dachas and lakes, forest and field, chatting to this serious young man. He was from the Kharkiv region, it turned out, so this was his trip home. I felt a bit similar, not coming home, but coming back to a place I truly love, a place that's been on my mind for 3 months, a constant gnawing fear for my friends here. Kharkiv was bombed from the very first day of the invasion. Aerial bombs dropped by roaring planes, a terror I just can't imagine, which left huge craters in the roads, in courtyards, next to blocks of flats. The destruction is extraordinary. We walked down historic Sumska Street in search of a shop with food and water. Almost nothing was open. An eerie silence prevailed, broken only by the occasional military vehicle roaring down empty streets. Glass crunched underfoot and all around the smashed windows and ruined facades gave a glimpse into what had happened here. I stayed for a week or so, documenting the devastation in the city and the surrounding villages which had been occupied by Russian troops. Whole neighbourhoods in the northern districts were reduced to burnt-out shells, just row upon row of ruined blocks of flats. One street there bears the name Friendship of the People, a Soviet slogan referring to the unity between Russia and its brotherly nations. The wall on which the sign is fixed had been sprayed with shrapnel. Walking around, we found buildings still smoking from the latest attack, and the sound of artillery was almost constant. But then there was a slight reprieve. When I came back again recently, the train was packed. Returning refugees, as many as 2,000 every day, coming back to a city that they felt was safe enough. The street outside the station was a riot of traffic and pedestrians. The contrast between this and my first visit was startling. Suddenly there were cafes, even bars, serving grateful customers. People deeply need normality, even a sliver of it. In these bars, behind smashed windows, young Kharkiv hipsters enjoyed beer and tortillas alongside journalists and military in body armour. And in the ruined villages, old women were planting vegetables in gardens half destroyed by shelling, the stink of bodies still in the air. In the days that followed, an extraordinary sight on the streets, trams, trolley buses. The mayor announced that the metro would reopen. Prompting an outcry, the platforms in the northern stations were still packed with people, mostly elderly and infirm, too scared to sleep at home. Was all this premature? Undoubtedly. The optimism ended on Thursday. I was walking through the beautiful Shevchenko Gardens, watching municipal workers cutting the grass. I listened to the strimmers whine, the chatter of passers-by, the birds' song. And then it was all cut off by a huge explosion to the northeast, an ear-splitting crack that made people duck instinctively. And then they straightened up and kept on walking. The contrast seemed absurd. I made my way to the media centre, conveniently located in a bunker, and there in the chilly air we tried to work while explosions continued overhead. Outgoing now, we reassured ourselves. But news began to filter in through the telegram channels. The death toll rose to 9, with many more injured. "Go back to shelter in the metro if you need to," the mayor said, "but we're going to keep the trains running." It's a compromise that can't go on forever, but there's a heavy feeling now that there is no end in sight for Kharkiv. Russia can't take this huge city, just like it couldn't take Kiev. But it's just 25 miles from here to the Russian border, bristling with guns and rocket launchers, tanks and troops. With a neighbour like this, what normality can really return here? For World Report, this is Jen Stout in Kharkiv.
To Australia next, where a left-of-centre opposition party has won the country's general election. The Labour Party's victory under the new Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, ends almost a decade of Conservative government. It was another milestone for Mr Albanese, who was brought up in public housing in Sydney by a single mother on benefits, and he said he hoped his journey would inspire Australians to reach for the stars. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Anthony Albanese has big plans, but just 3 years to achieve them. The new Prime Minister has promised unity and optimism, not fear and division. In a triumphant speech to supporters, he pledged action on global warming and Indigenous rights. He said Australia, which currently relies on coal for most of its electricity, had the opportunity to be a renewable energy superpower. On his first day in the job, he was off to meet the US president at the Quad Security Summit in Tokyo. He discussed China's growing assertiveness with Joe Biden, along with leaders from Japan and India. Mr. Albanese's election win, however, wasn't an overwhelming endorsement. Under a preferential voting system, only about a third of Australians chose his Labour Party as their first choice. The outgoing centre-right government was humiliated at the polls, losing several high-profile seats. The former Treasurer Josh Frydenberg was booted out of office. He was once considered to be a future Prime Minister. He still might be one day, but his wounded Liberal Party could take years to heal. But perhaps the biggest story of the 2022 election was the rise of the Australian Greens and independent candidates, many of whom campaigned strongly on climate action and political integrity. It seems certain that years of inertia on climate change under the previous administration are about to end under Mr. Albanese. Australia is, per person, one of the world's worst greenhouse gas polluters. Ending its reliance on coal is a priority, but no one's quite sure how bold the new government will be. In many ways, the election was a referendum on the man known as ScoMo. Scott Morrison became Prime Minister in 2018, but he never shook off the criticism of his handling of the Black Summer bushfires of 2019-20. He was on holiday in Hawaii when parts of the country were ablaze. When he did return home, forcing volunteer firefighters to shake his hand was a terrible look. Mr. Morrison's performance during the pandemic was mixed. He said that closing Australia's borders for more than 2 years and other tough public health measures saved thousands of lives. But the rollout of vaccines and the absence of testing kits when many Australians needed them the most saw his popularity dive. It plummeted even further when once again another natural disaster, record-breaking floods this year in eastern Australia, was mishandled. The country had seen enough, and the Morrison government is now history. The focus turns to a man with an Italian father who was teased at school about his surname. Anthony Albanese wants to change the constitution to give First Nations people a greater say over the laws that affect them. Guiding an economy with a record amount of debt out of the pandemic will be an even bigger challenge. As for Mr. Morrison, he was philosophical about his election defeat. Sometimes, he said, people like to change the curtains. For World Report, this is Phil Mercer in Sydney.
Finally, we go to Portugal and one of the poorest regions in the EU. Alentejo in southern Portugal has seen its fortunes transformed over the last 20 years, in line with the rise in Portugal's fortunes in general. For this once arid region, the building of the Alentejo Dam 20 years ago and the enormous man-made lake it created has played a vital role in this evolution, both as a source of irrigation and as a tourism resource. but it is an imperfect solution, and some believe that the disadvantages may in time outweigh the benefits. From Portugal, Conor Power reports.
Portugal's Alentejo region is a sparsely populated one that occupies almost half of the country. One of its most extraordinary features is Lake Alqueva. This is Western Europe's largest artificial lake. It was created by the construction of the Alqueva Dam 20 years ago, and the new lake took some 8 years to fill up. With its long, splintered form of what was once the valley of the Guadiana River, Lake Alqueva has a coastline that is longer than Portugal's entire maritime coastline. Today, this vast inland sea is a marvel to behold. Not only does it provide a source of irrigation for the parched Alentejan landscape, it's also a great tourism resource. Marinas have sprung up along its shorelines, as well as a number of praias fluviais, river beaches, complete with wide sandy strands, palm trees, restaurants and family beachside activities. And there was evidence on the ground too of the financial transformation that Lake Alqueva has brought. The impressive wine estate and luxury Herdade da Malagina Nova in central Alentejo grew from a dilapidated ranch purchased over 20 years ago by two brothers, João and Antonio Soares, who wished to realise their dream of owning their own vineyard. Their estate is a shining example of the Alentejo that is picking up and forging ahead, creating life and prosperity from a once barren place through industry and local job creation, all assisted by irrigated waters from Lake Alqueva. 20 minutes down the road from the Herdade lies the town of Beja, the capital of Beja Alentejo, or Lower Alentejo. From the top of its 4th century castle, you get a panoramic 360 degrees view of the vast plains of Beja Alentejo. Everywhere you look, you see orderly, productive, green fields. "This lake must have made an enormous difference to your lives here," I said to the local guide beside me. "Yes, well," he said, "most of the land you can see is owned by Spanish people. And most of the workers picking the olives and the almonds are from poorer countries such as India or Mozambique or Pakistan. You can see that the prosperity is being created, but it doesn't make that much difference to this town." Another voice of dissent I heard was from a Dutchman named Henk. Outside a cafe on a warm afternoon in Alentejo's extraordinarily beautiful capital city of Évora. A resident of Alentejo for over 30 years, Henk told me how last winter had been one of the warmest and loveliest that he had ever experienced since moving to Portugal. Then he turned to me and said, "But you know, southern Portugal is turning into a desert." "What?" I asked. "Even with Lake Alqueva?" "Even with Lake Alqueva, yes." The truth is that some people have been questioning the wisdom of the Great Lakes construction since the very beginning. One of those is José Paulo Martins, a veteran ecologist who works for the environmental group Zero. He is at pains to acknowledge that the dam has brought lots of great benefits to agriculture in the Alentejo, but it has also ramped up the agricultural industry in the region, turning what was a traditional montado landscape into an open-air factory producing a limited range of foodstuffs for export. Where once there was a more mixed variety of agriculture dominated by cereals, there are now thousands of hectares of olive trees, which are being replaced more and more by faster-growing almond trees. There's the environmental impact also. Lake Alqueva's water is down in a hollow and needs to be pumped up and out of the lake and across an increasingly wider area to keep up with agricultural production demands. This makes it an expensive commodity and without much benefit to the smallholder, who finds himself increasingly marginalised. The promises of the great Lake Alqueva project were never realistic, he says. Desertification is not just the lack of water, José points out. It's the degradation of the soil, and that's a problem we have had for many years. You can have the dam, but if you don't have good soil management, then the problem just continues. In the great rush to grow cash crops and vast acres of the newly irrigated Alentejo, he says, there's no one really looking out for the soil management, and the fear is that bad soil management practices are now being carried out on a vaster, more industrial scale than before. Treading water in Lake Alqueva at the tropical Praia Fluvial of Monserrate, in the shadow of this most exquisite hilltop village, seems a million miles away from the threat of desertification and soil degradation. All is certainly not right with this ingenious but flawed project, but so far it has brought some hope, colour and prosperity to what was once the EU's poorest region. For RT World Report in the Alentejo, Portugal, this is Conor Power.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. But until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.